conclusion I've come to is that there is a very powerful spiritual evolution going on this planet of awakening. It's, in fact, it's the most hopeful thing I see in humanity. Eckhart Tolle talks about it very beautifully. I find it very simply in A New Earth, about how the analogy of flowers, how at first there were just a few flowers, and then there were a lot, and then with evolution, flowers are everywhere. And the same thing he believes, and I believe, is happening with what we call awakening. It used to be something for a rare spiritual elite. That is no longer the case. People are evolving much faster than the spiritual communities are.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, our friend Joseph Rogue joins John and Scoop from Paris to discuss meditation and spirituality. We discuss the quest for spirituality, organizing a group to explore spirituality versus spirituality for profit. We also talk about violence in the media.
For this episode of the Plutopia News Network, we'd like to welcome our friend Joseph Rowe. We're going to talk about spiritual community today. Joseph is a musician, a composer, a writer, a storyteller. He has a long association with Catherine Broslovsky, and they perform mostly in France and other places. Joseph is also an author and a translator, and he's a meditator and teacher. So, Joseph, welcome.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Happy you're here. So, do you consider yourself part of any particular meditative tradition?
That's a good question. I would say yes and no. I feel that one of the great advantages of our time, the era we live in, is having access to all the great traditions. And I feel it's very important to, as the saying goes, take the best and leave the rest. And I know there are people who disagree with this, very, very thoughtful people, traditionalists, who claim that you have to stay with one tradition. And I very much disagree with that. I think it's true for some people, but I think it's completely illegitimate to generalize that. And so, I have participated in a number of traditional spiritual communities, mostly Buddhist and some Sufi and some Christian, kind of Christian Zen, actually.
And maybe Gurdjieffian, too.
And Gurdjieff, that's way. Right. Yeah. Gurdjieff, to me, is a kind of a branch of the larger Sufism. He definitely came from the Sufi tradition. And so that pretty much sums it up.
It sounds like you're using a technique that is common among technology people and makers of modding. It's not just going with one strict version of meditation, but you've made a version that works for you. Is that how you would see it?
Yes. A combination of techniques which work very well for me and for others that I've shared it with also.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's not particularly healthy to eat the same meal every day, so it makes sense that it wouldn't be necessarily healthy to follow a single path throughout your life.
Yeah, that's a very individual thing, yeah.
So we were going to discuss skillful means for spiritual community, for enhancing online connections, especially for people who are dedicated to spiritual awakening. And there was a quote in a piece of yours that I read recently, where you were writing about an experience you had with Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist who is quite well known and is the founder of the Plum Village community. And another one of our regular guests, Gary Gock, is part of that community too. And the quote is, surely what we need most is enlightened community. We've had many enlightened individuals, but when we have never seen an entire community, but when have we ever seen an entire community which is enlightened? It may even seem impossible. But who says this cannot be? How can you know? Why not a family, a tribe, a village of awakened beings, and then a city, a region, even a whole country? And why not an awakened world? This is the only useful meaning I can find in such prophecies.
Yeah, he was referring to the prophecy of some great coming savior.
Maitreya, yeah.
Maitreya, yeah.
So this question of spiritual community and online community sort of working together, you had discussed how you haven't really found that in any effective way. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much correct. I find online communities that have certain virtues. That's why I keep subscribing to them and visiting them. But I don't find any one that is entirely satisfactory. And this isn't just about online either. I think we tend to talk a lot about online now because of the COVID crisis, but let's not forget that really we human beings thrive in personal presence together too, and more than online. And whether it's one or the other, I find that I can't, having attempted to belong to various communities, I find that I can't find anyone where I find my place, where I really find my place. And for a long time, I thought that that was about me. And then I looked around me and I saw millions and millions of other people who were reporting the same thing. And I began to ask questions of some of them. And of course, it's true that some people are on a big individualistic trip and are they're loners of one kind or another or something like that. But that was not at all the most common report. The most common report was that simply, it was kind of like me, is that people couldn't find their place. And what finally, to make a long story short, what the conclusion I've come to is that there is a very powerful spiritual evolution going on this planet of awakening. It's, in fact, it's the most hopeful thing I see in humanity. Eckhart Tolle talks about it very beautifully. I find it very simply in A New Earth, about how the analogy of flowers, how at first there were just a few flowers, then there were a lot, and then with evolution, flowers were everywhere. And the same thing he believes, and I believe, is happening with what we call awakening. It used to be something for a rare spiritual elite. That is no longer the case. People are evolving much faster than the spiritual communities are. The spiritual communities are stuck in worship of tradition, just holding on to bibliolatry is one form of it, you know, worshiping scriptures. instead of God, so to speak. And these communities, by and large, are not evolving as nearly as fast as individuals are.
So you're saying that there is a broad awakening among individuals that is not represented well in communities. Yeah. And you use the flower metaphor, but I wonder about the weeds. If you pay attention to media and to the common perception of what's going on in the world, it seems that we're devolving rather than evolving.
It can certainly seem like that. But part of that is because we're fascinated by bad news and we're bored by good news.
I got that, yeah. There's QAnon, which is kind of a religion, but it's a very strange one. There's a lot of conspiracy theories and craziness. We talk about that quite a bit on here, actually.
Yeah, because this kind of new form of in French they call it complotisme. It's this kind of new phenomenon of finding conspiracies everywhere. It doesn't matter whether it's right, left, whatever. Just looking for conspiracies and believing you've detected them. That tendency to me is simply very simple. That is a symptom of lack of tolerance of the unknown. That's all. People who gravitate toward conspiracies cannot tolerate living in the unknown or not being sure. We just don't know.
Yeah, they can't fill in the blanks, so they just filling it in with weirdness.
Do you think it also relates to the fact that a lot of people out there just they can't find answers that relate to them, so they'll just grasp upon any stray conspiracy theory that pops up and use that in place of any kind of actual spiritual connection?
Right. Whereas the Buddhist, one thing I really appreciate about Buddhism is kind of the opposite of conspiracism. Do you remember the story of the empty boat? That this boatman is in the night is trying to avoid this boat, but it keeps coming at him. He curses it, he yells at it, and the guy refuses to listen. And it just slams into him, and he's just outraged. He's ready to kill somebody, and there's nobody on the boat. There's nobody there. And this is kind of a metaphor for what is our common delusion and our common source of so much of our aggression and our craziness is belief in somebody's there. Somebody's doing it, somebody's behind this, somebody did it, somebody wants it to be done, somebody is, goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Everybody needs a boogeyman to blame, yeah. Someone that's the evil genius behind all their problems.
Right.
So, one of the things that we've been talking about is how, I mean, you've talked about how there is this awakening among individuals not well represented in spiritual communities. So I think your question has been, how can you bring those people who are awakening into some sense of community with each other without getting into the kind of ruts that some spiritual, supposedly spiritual communities are already in? And one observation, something like QAnon or some of these weird conspiracy theories seem to have a pretty good job of bringing people in and spreading virally. So would there be some way to do that with some sane sense of being awake and being non-delusional and present in the world?
I don't know if it's a good idea to spread virally. I think one of the problems actually is filtering, keeping groups small. If there's any hope to come together in that way, then we can't just make everybody welcome. It just won't work.
Well, I just think in terms of the Bodhisattva ideal, the idea that I am awakening, and I will bring all the people I can with me. So I try to spread my awakening.
It ain't going to happen virally, though.
How does it happen then? How do you manage to bring everybody on board the boat?
I'm more worried about just getting any kind of boat working at all at first before bringing everybody aboard it. There's a lot of people there, but first we can. I don't have any. I just know that this needs to be done, but I don't know how to do it exactly. I can tell you some things that are lacking in communities that exist online. Maybe we should just talk about online, okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Other things are the other. It's a bigger, too big a question with the other kinds. I'll give an example. I belong to an online community called the Mystery School, which is run by Jeff Carrera, who is a really superb meditation teacher. But one thing that's lacking in that community is lively conversation. It's just and relevant conversation. And relevant conversation about why we are awakening as individuals and not together. And that just is not happening in that community. And another example, there's a woman named Patricia Albert. Don't know exactly how to pronounce her name, A-L-B-E-R-E. And she has a movement, she kind of guides a movement called Mutual Awakening. And she is very much aware of this problem I'm talking about and trying to overcome it by bringing people together in a process that she calls Mutual Awakening. But so far, I haven't really joined that community paid because you got to pay, you know. By the way, just not to digress too much, but too many of these communities are just, we find ourselves reduced to consumers. Well, that's really the problem right there.
So spirituality for profit seems to be the motive in some of these communities, you think?
You know, I don't think it's even that. I don't think it's they really want that. I don't think, for example, Jeff Carrera is interested in profit primarily, but that's the model that he succumbs to and that people tend to succumb to. And Craig Hamilton is another example, a wonderful meditation teacher. But his community, you just become a consumer by joining his community. I was a member of it for some time, and I got tremendous benefit from it for a while, some really good guided meditations. But you just become a consumer, you know.
Well, you know, there's a meditation teacher that I follow who's like this former punk rocker, Brad Warner, who has written several books about Buddhism and is very good at making like clear explanations of Buddhist thinking. And really the only way he has to support himself is through writing the books, but also I think he depends somewhat on donations or contributions from the people who follow him. And, you know, that necessity to find some way to proceed in life and to pay bills and so forth, I think sort of lends to almost a requirement to to build something of a consumption model. I mean, in a sense, you're selling wisdom, or you're selling an opportunity to awaken.
That's a very serious problem. And Eckhart Tolle has pretty much succumbed to that. Even though he personally is not, I'm sure of that. Unless I'm totally mistaken about the man, I followed him very deeply. At first I thought Eckhart Tolle was kind of watered down mysticism for the masses. I totally changed my mind. I think he's one of the most profound teachers and effective teachers of this age. But his very success has created a situation where many people, not just him, not just about him making a living and a very good living, extremely good living. It's about supporting a whole group of people who depend on the Eckhart Tolle industry. And that kind of model does not build the kind of community we need. It's good. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm glad it's there. It's helped a lot of people, and it is what it is. It does what its job is very well, but it falls far short of what we're talking about.
That model has been a big influence on Christianity. You have all the mega churches, which are really just mega corporations that are generating a lot of cash, and hopefully those people are getting some benefit. But the goal of these mega churches seems to be cashing in on the spiritual needs of others.
Yeah, that's really grotesque. Yeah, it's a grotesque example of it. One spiritual teacher who does not do this is Shenzhen Yung. He is one of my main teachers. In fact, my guides, my elder brothers and sisters on the path, you might say. Shenzhen is a really incredible person. He's not only is he a Zen master, but he's a real expert on world religions and a multilingualist and extremely literate in science and mathematics. And he charges a very minimum, the Dana principle. You know about that, Dana?
Yeah. He also has an online store where he sells, I guess, his talks and guided meditations and that sort of thing. And he's got a book. And I mean, he's doing various things.
Yeah, but he doesn't charge, but for his, he charges less than anybody else does to be online with him. It's $20 for a retreat. That's pretty.
It's very reasonable. Yeah. So he's still trying to support himself with his work, but he's not being greedy about
it. It's still not the model we need. That's right. It's one of the better, it's one of the purer examples of this, but it's not, it's still not what we need.
Well, it sounds like we kind of need a community. I mean, from my perspective, being a person who adheres to a cooperative model and, you know, was part of a co-op, it seems to me that this idea of having to have a single teacher that you follow, that we could be rethinking that and think about how within the community, members of the community could all be both teaching and learning. And in that case, also no member of the community would necessarily be depending on teaching for an income, you know?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I would tend to certainly, here's another thing about evolution. The huge thing that's in the background of all this is the question about evolution. What is evolution? And I can understand that some Eastern traditions feel that Westerners are too obsessed with and over-optimistic about evolution, and are taking technology as a kind of a, which is totally out of hand as a model for evolution. I understand that, but on the other hand, there is evolution, and we have evolved spiritually and collectively to a point where that guru model no longer works. Perhaps it was valid, probably was in some society at some time. It's not what we need, the guru model. It's leader, yes, leadership, yes. We do need leadership. That's only natural. But the question is, how do we have leadership without the guru model and without, as you say, people depending on money from spiritual teachings in order to make a living?
Yeah, it's sort of like the idea of the headless organization. Can you have an organization and have it be effective and have it move in, you know, a meaningful direction without having a CEO or a director or a leader? I mean, conceptually, we have adapted throughout the history, human history, really, to this idea that it works best to have one person in the lead and others following. Birds do it a little differently. I mean, if you follow a flock of birds, you see that there's not a leader, but the leadership is, or the sense of direction of
absolutely,
the flock is collectively determined with different people or different birds getting into the lead at different times.
Starlings, especially. Starlings are incredible, yeah.
And it's been hard for humans to figure out how to do that. And I know I've been... In the time that I spent within the cooperative framework, that has especially been difficult to scale. If you have a smaller co-op, as we did, with just a few members, it's not difficult at all to have that kind of shared leadership and collective sense of direction. But as you grow and as you get more people into the mix, it becomes harder and harder to do that.
That's right. That's the point I was trying to make before, is that it's best to start small, not to have. It's when I look over the history of what's happened to various spiritual communities, which is a subject that fascinates me, big and small, through thousands of years or recently, all eras. You know, when I look all that over, one thing that really comes out is that small is beautiful, at least at first. It's very hard. When it gets beyond a certain point, institutionalization starts to set in.
I experienced a leaderless project at one point where a company I was working for, the manager decided we're going to do this project, but I'm not going to be involved. We just put a bunch of people into a office and said, you need to accomplish this. And no one was a title. It was just, you're all on the project. And it was the most chaotic thing I've ever, it was fine when there were just a few people as it was developing. When it got to be a large group, the emergence of people who want to be king was starting to happen, and that's suddenly there's cliques forming, and that kind of thing is pretty much self-defeating.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and those are like
that's a very important point.
Those are human tendencies. Oh, I'm sorry. Those are human tendencies we kind of have to figure out how to overcome in order to make this work.
But you brought up a very important point, is that that ideal is impossible. It's totally unrealistic in the context of ego, people living from ego, ego consciousness.
Well, that gets to another thing that we were going to talk about, which is in these communities that exist where there is this guru or teacher or person at the top or the center, the potential for scandal, the potential for that person to abuse his or her role.
Yeah.
You know, and we've seen that. We've seen that within the Shambhala community, and we've seen that within, like, Buddhist communities.
That's right. Chogyam Trungpa, also Tenzin.
Yeah, and also Noah Levine.
Noah Levine?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I hadn't heard about that.
Oh, well.
Well, you're the...
He had some people accused him of some things, and the whole... the whole organization sort of fell apart. But I think he's still out and still teaching as far as that goes.
Well, of course, that brings up another question. Is there is also a very strong phenomenon of false accusation and people with an axe to grind. For example, there's a guy who's, I think he's kind of calmed down and disappeared now, but a couple of years ago, he was ranting and raving about Shenzhen Young. And I really looked into it carefully because I want to know about the shadow side of teachers. And it was total bullshit. It was this guy's. And another example, there's a very famous book that came out called Lives in the Shadow with Jay Krishnamurti. That book is a total fraud. It's supposed to be an unmasking of Krishnamurti. And really, it's just a rant, a totally biased rant by a woman who, but it took me a long time to find that out. I totally bought into that book at first.
Yeah, I mean, when you hear these things and you don't hear the facts and the details, it's too easy to default to belief. But it's like the thing with Noah Levine, if you like look closely at it, and Against the Stream, and Against the Stream no longer exists because of this. But that's really unfortunate because, you know, he had done some things that were like made people uncomfortable, apparently, or there was a question of whether he had used his position incorrectly, you know, or in order to take advantage of people. And I don't think he felt he was doing that from what I've been able to read. But the perception was that he was doing that. So the whole thing
unraveled. Whether he was or wasn't, the question is, in our context, how did it come about that an entire community disappeared just because there's a misbehavior or perceived misbehavior of one person?
So, you know, in the Buddhist sense, I mean, if you read Dogen, you know that the entire community didn't really disappear. Nothing ever goes away. It just transforms. And all of those people in that community are still doing, I guess, things similar to what they had been doing before, but they're just not doing it as part of that community. So while the community entity unraveled, I had been reading something recently about, this is in Sapiens, I think, actually, where he talks about, how we create total fictions and call them like organizations. And the organization is really a fiction, you know, something that we call a company that has a brand attached to it.
It's a story.
It doesn't really exist. It's just a bunch of people who are conforming to a narrative. Yeah, exactly.
That's a wonderful book, Sapiens. It's the first book I've ever read. It's probably not the only one that exists to my knowledge, of a really top-level academic historian who meditates.
And it's an excellent book. It's a very enlightening book, too.
It shows. The fact that he's a meditator really shows. Yeah.
So I don't think that... I wouldn't say that Against the Stream went away. I just think that it was reconfigured, and the name stopped meaning anything.
Well, anyway, we get a little bit sidetracked there. I think the question was, the thread, I think, was that these scandals have kind of shaken us awake to the fact that we have to find a better model than the guru model. And we don't know how to do that because the way I see it, the only hope of a group of people, even a small group, coming together and finding and having this higher intelligence emerge without having to have a central figure all the time. Although there may be some temporary leadership needed, you know, that's normal. The only hope that that can happen, seems to me, is among people who have individually already gone beyond the ego operation, or at least they can do that in this sacred space. They can really let go of belief and operation from a perceived separate self.
Would that be kind of like trying to build an anarchist organization, that kind of oxymoron?
Might seem like that, but I don't see any other way.
I mean, the question is,
as soon as you start,
would those people come together, and how would they adhere?
Well, as they have to, the group, I'll put it this way. How would they adhere? By simple thirst, by the thirst for collective awakening, is the next stage in human evolution. Passion for that, that's what brings them together. That's no problem with that. But the motivation is very powerful. But the problem is, you have to have a means, have to have a skillful means of detecting emergences of ego and putting a stop to it without the emergence of a group ego.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one question is, do you really transcend ego, or do you just sort of put it in its place? You know, ego, if you think of it as being something like the default mode network that Michael Pollan talks about, it's a component of the system, sort of. It's part of the human machine. I really don't like to use the term human machine, but like the human operating system, whatever. And if it was to truly go away, then there would be a kind of dysfunction, I would assume. The challenge is to be able to accept that it's there, but to understand that it's not either that it's not real or that it has no independent reality.
It is not real. It's a game. You got to understand it's a game. It's a game that got out of hand.
And the question is how to get the game, how to constrain it to the point that it serves its purpose, but it doesn't dominate.
You stop believing it. You don't believe in it anymore. You can't accept it. If you can't have your cake and eat it too, you can't accept the reality of ego.
But what is it that stops believing?
Intelligence. I mean,
does the belief... Isn't the belief associated with the ego?
So ego would
have to stop believing in ego.
No, I don't agree. No, this mind stream, body stream does not agree.
There's okay, well, what is it if it's not ego?
It's what Krishnamurti called the awakening of intelligence.
So we think of a human as having an intelligence, but that intelligence is not the ego. It's something else.
Right.
And it's in both the body and the mind. Is that correct?
Sure. It manifests through body and mind. I wouldn't say it originates there, but it manifests there.
Or is it beyond individual body and mind? Because we all know that, guys like you and I tend to agree that everything is interdependent and everything is connected.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's like a wave upon the ocean, as they say.
Yeah. A wave upon the ocean saying, I'm so lonely out here in the midst of...
but the water's right there. Come on in. The water's fine. So now we're at a great silence. We could probably meditate right now.
Well, you were talking about evolution, and I'm an observer of politics. And looking at the crowd out there in world politics, it's hard to spot whether someone is evolving or devolving. I mean, just the things that are being done, and they're supposedly experts and the chosen people. How do you determine which way these people are going? Are they evolving or devolving?
Spiritually. I really like the model of Stanislav Grof. I actually had the good luck to talk to him once, and I've read his books. Do you know who he is?
No.
Stanislav Grof, G-R-O-F. He was one of the LSD pioneers and one of the most really profound investigators of the recall of birth trauma and various things like that. And in his work with thousands of people, not just with LSD, but also with what he calls hypertrophic breathing, which is very much like a Sufi zikr, he came up with four stages of which are kind of archetypes of evolution. And some parts are kind of like what you call devolution, Scoop. And I'll try to outline them. The first part, and they correspond to our own birth process, by the way. The first process is blissful union with the mother in the womb. Number two, that's number one, he calls it BPM, basic perinatal matrix, BPM one. BPM two is blockage, a sense of blockage, that something needs to emerge and it can't emerge. And that's a moment of extreme struggle and kind of angst. The third one is the emergence. And there you have absolute chaos of everything good and everything bad is happening at once. The horror of having to leave this world of bliss is there. And all the kind of perception of all the horrors that go with it. And at the same time, the wonder and beauty of this new world is there. And it's all happening at once. What we call devolution and evolution. It's the good and the bad. It's all happening at the same time. And then the final stage, BPM4, is kind of a BPM1 on a higher octave. Full individuation and union in a higher sense, which is kind of mysterious. But when I talked to Grof, I asked him which stage he thought the human race was in now. And he said three. I thought he might say two, but he said three. He said, it's all happening at once. The worst and the best are happening right together. And that's typical of this stage.
Yeah, and that's to your point earlier about how there's this great awakening happening at the same time there's this great insanity happening.
Yeah, right.
And we see the insanity because it's represented in media, but we don't see the awakening because it's not sexy enough, I guess.
Yeah, that's the terrible thing. There's a Jungian psychologist named Robert Johnson describes that as our Dionysian thirst. Dionysus in us, according to him, I'm not saying I agree with this, but it's very intriguing. He said, there's something in us as an archetype, a god or a kind of higher archetype in us of Dionysus, which wants, or maybe Shiva, the same thing, which wants destruction, which is loves bad news, absolutely loves bad news. It thrives on horror.
And also conflict and friction. You know, the conflict and friction. I was in a conversation earlier today about how so much of what we're seeing in the world right now is not just people falling into a conflict, but people going out of their way to create conflict, you know?
Absolutely.
That's a good way to be noticed.
Might not exist.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That's a good way of getting noticed because having worked as a journalist for a long time during some very disturbing times, getting your story published was easier if it was something dire, something horrible, some really traumatic thing. If it was a story that was good and cheerful, that usually, if it got published, it got on the back page. The front page is all the horror and the dispute and everything else that goes with, you know, doing the news. And it seems to have gotten worse, especially on cable news. You know, you see the horror, but you seldom see all the good things.
Yeah, and it's not just news. It's movies. It's everything. I feel the media bear a tremendous, if there are any villains in this, I believe it's the media's catering to the worst, absolutely the worst things in people.
Yeah, and on the other hand, though, is there are people who preach that, you know, you shouldn't protest. You shouldn't speak out against injustice. So there seems to be a need for a balance. You know, sometimes you do need to stir things up because someone is doing something horrifying to you or your people. So how do you strike that balance?
Well, I think we're talking about different things. I'm talking about really catering to people's thirst for violence, about movies especially. Have you ever noticed, here's a simple way to measure that. How many times in your life have you seen someone pull a gun, a pistol?
Never.
A number of times, actually, growing up in Texas.
I've seen it twice in my life. And most people are going to report something like that. But if a Martian or some was to come and study us with our movies, they would conclude that people are pulling pistols all the time.
Well, in Texas, that may be the fact. It's gun city down here.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of guns here, but I never see anybody carrying a gun, and I've never seen anybody like actually point a gun at another person.
This doesn't have anything to do with NRA or anything like that. This is the media, which always are holding pistols in our faces,
exactly.
You know, literally. Always thrusting pistols at us in the story. You can't even have a story without several pistols in it.
Yeah, you know, actually, I've grown more sensitive to that. My wife and I both, we find that one thing that we can do here when we're sheltering in place and not going much of anywhere is watch television. And we've sort of browse through a lot of the programming that's available. And so much of it is violent and bloody and really kind of horrible stuff. And it didn't really strike us before because we weren't doing it very much or we weren't looking that much at what was available. But now it's so obvious, you know, and you wonder what kind of, you know, I mean, garbage in, garbage out, how our heads are being conditioned with all of this violence and blood.
Yeah, these school shootings and everything. I feel that the media are at least as much to blame as the NRA.
Well, there are the copycats who see those stories and it's like, well, I want to be that famous as well. So there, that is a common occurrence right after a major, mass murder.
Yeah. Well, and not only that makes two different ways that the media are to blame. By the way, they are fascinated by reporting that in great, great detail, and also the Hollywood movies that glorify that kind of, that glorify having a pistol, get yourself a gun and get yourself respected, you know.
So we're sort of at the end of our time here with a kind of cliffhanger here. And I will just say, we'd love to have you back, and your assignment between now and then is to figure out the solution to this problem.
Are we making him a guru doing that?
He's a guru whether he likes it or not.
Or just a co-conspirator.
Well, thanks, Joseph. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. It's been a great pleasure. Good questions. Thank you.
We will see you soon.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.